Chapter 56. The next morning, Divine called in sick and then met Montgomery at the train station. She was wearing jeans and a long-sleeved shirt and black ankle boots. He passed her his spare helmet, she climbed on, and they set off for Connecticut. When they arrived at the address, they saw that Elaine Nestor's cottage was small but quaint, with gray cedar shake siding, white trim, and beds filled with colorful summer flowers. Hers was the only house on the macadam rural road. When they knocked on the door, a woman answered. She was in her late 40s with graying hair cut short on the sides, with one long bang in the front and black-rimmed glasses on a chain around her neck. She looked more like a caricature of a librarian than a hard-charging financial journalist digging up dirt on the wealthy and powerful, but her features were alert and her eyes bright and probing. Elaine Nestor?
Yes. Who are you?
He saw a phone in one hand and a wooden mallet in the other. But when she saw Montgomery standing next to him, she relaxed just a bit. My name is Travis Divine. This is my friend Michelle. I work at Cowlin Co- That got the door slammed right in his face. Should have seen that coming, idiot. He glanced at Montgomery, whose expression said pretty much the same thing. He called out, I read your article on Brad Cowell. The one that got your career torpedoed. I just wanted to tell you that you were right. The door slowly opened, but Nestor's look remained suspicious.
Why are you here? What do you want?
Have you read about the murders?
Of course I have. And what do you mean I was right?
Divine had prepared what he was about to say on the ride up. I think Cowell is running the biggest money laundering scheme in the history of the world, and would you like your career back? Nestor stared at him for an uncomfortably long moment.
Would you both like some coffee?
3 cups of coffee later, Nestor was still shaking her head.
Area 51, really?
Really? As crazy as it sounds.
It doesn't sound crazy. People will do anything to make money, but you took a huge risk doing what you did.
He looked at Montgomery, who was fingering her coffee cup and looking pensively out the window into the rear garden. I had incentive enough.
You asked me about Brad Cowell, and I told you what I thought. He's a slick operator and can talk a good game, but if he knows the difference between an LBO and HBO, I'll run naked down the street. And he did inherit a lot of money, and he blew it on coke and women and shady investment types who took him to the cleaners. And I have the receipts to prove it. He's a front man, plain and simple. And I wrote all about that in my article. And then I got my ass handed to me and basically run out of town on a rail. It's just history repeating itself. Anyone who had the temerity to question Bernie Madoff's guaranteed returns got the same treatment for decades.
Nobody wanted to pop the illusion,
interjected Montgomery.
It's the Emperor's New Clothes syndrome.
Nestor eyed her.
Nobody likes to admit they were suckered. It's easier on the psyche to keep living the lie.
But not easier on the wallet. It has to come to a head. Although Cowell is not running a Ponzi scheme, I think what he's doing is actually a lot worse. It goes right to this country's national security interests. Nestor nodded.
I'm sure you read about the Panama Papers and, more recently, the Pandora Papers. It's no secret to those in the industry that rich people from all over the world have been stashing trillions in opaque trusts that run from generation to generation, in perpetuity. And they don't pay a dime of tax on any of it, ever. A lot of it is illegal money from cartels, terrorist organizations, deposed dictators who have emptied treasuries, ransomware players. Creditors can't touch it, and the people whose money it really is can never recover it.
I read that South Dakota is sitting on over $600 billion of that trust money, said Divine. It creates a few hundred jobs in the state, but it sucked the lifeblood out of places where that money originated. And Wyoming has something called the cowboy cocktail that has even more privacy layers. Nestor nodded.
You can be the trust's grantor and the beneficiary. And the people running the trust have no clue who the real owners are. They just see account numbers. You've got do-nothing descendants who haven't worked a day in their lives, and they have their own jets courtesy of these tax-robbing schemes.
Divine added, And you have some high and mighty politicians screaming about working class Joes pulling three jobs, getting a few hundred extra bucks a month in government benefits because they think it'll make them lazy.
From the scale you mentioned, I can imagine it being Russian oligarchs and Saudi princes. Dictators who have raided national treasuries, crime syndicates, drug cartels. Your run-of-the-mill billionaires with criminal sides to their businesses. Or legit ones who just want to offload money to avoid taxes and acquire more wealth surreptitiously and then pass it down from generation to generation without the taxman getting a dime.
Devine said, "But there's more to it than that. This money is not sitting in stock and bond portfolios. From what I saw, they're buying huge chunks of this country with it." Nestor shook her head.
"Can you imagine if the Taliban or Iran or North Korea or Russia were getting cash flow from investments in this country to fund their terrorist activities? Kim Jong-un, a landlord in New York? An Iranian Ayatollah owning hog farms in Kansas? Or Putin having oil fields in Texas? That would be the scandal of the century."
"How do you think this all started? I know that Cal left the country over 2 decades ago and was gone for a while."
"He had burned through all his inheritance by then, and he had some personal scandals he was dealing with. Over 20 years ago, when I'd only been an investigative journalist for a few years, I traced a meeting that Cal had with some shady people in the Seychelles, but then the trail went cold. Then he dropped off the radar for about a year or so. He might have been in Asia or Eastern Europe, at least those were my best guesses. Next, the man waltzes back into New York, buys and rehabs that skyscraper, starts his investment group, hires all sorts of pricey talent, suddenly has a client list that the biggest players on Wall Street would covet, and boom, he's the talk of the town. He wasn't even 25 years old."
"And no one really questioned that? That seems crazy."
"The money folks will forgive a lot if the cash keeps rolling in. Same goes for the government. Cal's operations bring millions to the city and state in taxes. He employs lots of people, and they also pay taxes and spend money there. He greases the palms of politicians he needs to. He gives liberally to charities, always good for a funny one-liner or an expert diatribe on a business show. Lives life fast and hard, but backs up the talk with results, and he can afford an army of lawyers. Who's going after a guy like that? Hell, I'm living proof of that."
Nestor looked at Montgomery.
"Now, this signaling technique using a bikini is intriguing and unique."
"Not the words I would use for it,"
said Montgomery, looking embarrassed. "I actually thought it was cumbersome," interjected Devine. "It just seems like sending an email would be a lot more efficient."
"I think I can shed some light on that. About 12 years ago, Cal came really, really close to being indicted by the Justice Department and the state of New York for some financial shenanigans. I mean, huge fines, delicensing, and possible prison time. They got onto him by electronic eavesdropping, phone, computer, associates electronics. He used his money and influence and a fleet of high-priced attorneys and calling in chits from political pals to get out of the jam, but..."
"But it would make the man paranoid about relying on those types of communications again," interjected Devine. "He actually mentioned to me something along the lines of what you just said. He told me for the important stuff, he always went analog."
"And let me tell you something else. Anne Cumley? I spent years trying to track her down. She doesn't exist, I'm sure of it."
"I watched an old interview where Cal said she might just represent an idea or something like that."
"Well, maybe now we have our answer. It represents a criminal enterprise."
She eyed Devine over her coffee cup.
"So what will you do now?"
"Keep following the money. And anything we do find goes right to you for your exclusive. I want to make sure you come out of this with your career and good reputation back."
"I appreciate that very much, Mr. Devine. But what about the murders? Do you think these two women found out what was going on and that's why they were killed?"
"Hughes knew about the Locust Group. Stamos was her lover and was also sleeping with Cowell. He might have let something slip over pillow talk, and Hughes and later Stamos followed up on it. And they were both murdered, maybe as a result."
"Financial crimes are one thing. Killing people is totally something else."
"I don't think Cal is calling the shots here. Not really. I've run into some goons who decided my time on Earth was up. Luckily, they were wrong. But it was strongly intimated that Cowell is not running this show.
If Brad Cowell is involved with the sorts of people it looks like he is, this will become even more dangerous.
I'm actually sort of counting on it. Chapter 57. On the way back to New York, Devine and Montgomery stopped and had lunch at a restaurant on the water. They sat at an outside table overlooking Long Island Sound. It wasn't too hot. The breeze off the water was pleasant and refreshing, and the views were lovely. Still, Montgomery stared sulkily off before glancing at Devine.
Doesn't sitting here just make you want to chuck it?
Chuck what?
You know exactly what I'm talking about, Travis.
He sat back and looked out to the water, where a sailboat was cutting through the waves. Gotta make a living. I'm not rich. I'm not even well off enough to take a vacation.
I've got my portfolio.
Then you can chuck it, Michelle.
Not that much fun alone. You could come along for the ride.
There are about a million other guys who'd be a lot better for you than me.
And I can't make that decision for myself.
Yes, but I also have to make that decision for myself. She hiked her eyebrows.
And you have no interest.
I think you know that I do, but I've got baggage that you don't need to deal with.
And you think I don't?
And you don't believe that'll be a red flag for them to hunt us down if we suddenly disappear together?
I suppose it would be.
She studied him closely.
Why are you really at Cowell, Travis? You don't strike me as a person interested in that world at all.
He started to tell her the standard line, but then he decided to be more candid. His conversation with Campbell had made him reevaluate things, and Montgomery had stuck her neck out for him. She deserved something close to the truth. I left the army under a sort of cloud. It messed with my head. My old man always wanted me to go for the money, so I decided to do what he wanted.
Even though you really didn't want to?
I guess it was a form of self-punishment. Force myself to do what I hate.
What the hell happened in the army to make you want to do that to yourself?
I can't talk to you about it. I can barely talk to myself about it.
Okay. I guess I can understand that.
She said slowly, but looking disappointed. You said your family situation wasn't a ball of fun.
I'm the black sheep, I guess. Never lived up to my promise, or so my mother told me.
Come on, you're only, what, 22?
Almost 23. I should have graduated from college by now. I'm way behind, Travis. No way to catch up, really. It's like being in the 19th century and suddenly realizing you're a washed-up old maid at age 18.
I went back to school after getting out of the army. It can be done.
But that's not what I want. I just want to travel to different places, experience different things. I don't want to be tied down to a desk or a computer for the rest of my life. But now I'm arm candy for a rich criminal.
But you got me into Area 51. You went with me to see Nestor. She stared moodily off.
Where do you think Brad is now?
It's anybody's guess. I don't think they found the surveillance device I put in there, because I can still see the space.
Maybe, and maybe not. They might have found it but didn't remove it, so you wouldn't know they had discovered it. Give them time to come up with a counterattack.
You're getting good at this stuff.
Not really, but I'm going to need to be.
What do you mean?
The thing is, Travis, they're going to eventually realize how that camera got in there. And when they do, we are both going to be in deep shit.
Chapter 58. They rode back to New York. Devine pulled in front of the walk-up, and Montgomery climbed off and passed him the spare helmet.
Can you come up for a little bit? Now that it's fully hit me that I was the unwitting messenger for a criminal syndicate, I don't want to be alone. I might slip my wrists.
Don't joke about that.
I'm not joking.
They went upstairs, got beers, and returned to the roof and sat in the deck chairs. Now, you said you met Cowell about a year ago, but I imagine Area 51 has been going on a lot longer than that.
So, How did they work the signals before me? Did he just use a different method?
He built the house that the train overlooks 3 years ago. And now I guess I understand why he allowed a gap between the tree canopies and the wall so the person on the train could see. So maybe that method of communication dates back to then.
You know, one morning while I was there, I couldn't sleep and got up early. I looked out the window, and Brad was raising the umbrella at one of the tables by the pool.
Red or green? She thought for a moment.
Red. I thought it was odd. I mean, it was so early. And I think the train came by a few minutes later.
Devine looked thoughtful. There was a guy on the train who said he saw another woman by the pool before you hooked up with Cal. She was a brunette, and she wore a bikini early in the morning sometimes, too.
Really?
Yeah. She sat back, looking perplexed at first, and then a look of understanding came into her eyes.
I thought Christian was helping me by introducing me to Brad in Italy. But maybe Brad was looking for a new messenger girl, and Christian was really helping him.
I think you might be right. Hey, do you think this brunette might have stayed in this building too? Michelle suddenly became rigid.
When I was moving some things into my bedroom here, I found a credit card slip that had fallen behind a drawer.
Devine perked up at this. Do you remember the name on the credit card?
I do, actually, because it was so unusual. Dominique Devereaux. Very alliterative. I mean, it sounds fake.
Devine took out his phone and searched the name. Okay, Dominique Devereaux was a character on the TV show Dynasty, both in the original series back in the 1980s and then on the reboot on the CW.
Maybe it was an alias then.
Hold on, here's another Dominique Devereaux. He clicked on a link and read down the page. Age 24, originally from California, and... He stopped speaking and stared at the screen, his look troubled.
And what, Travis?
He glanced up at her. Devereaux killed herself nearly 1 year ago by jumping into the East River. Chapter 59. Devine rode back to the townhouse in Mount Kisco. After they learned about Devereaux's fate, he and Michelle had first talked about her going into hiding. He had even thought about calling up Campbell to have his people protect her. But in the end, they had decided that her best protection was to stay put, to not let Cowell or others know that anything was amiss. But he had told her to keep a watch out and call the cops if anything looked off. He had communicated with Campbell about these latest developments and his meeting with Elaine Nestor, and arranged to meet with the man later. There was no one at the townhouse at this time of the day. Valentine wasn't on the couch, and the Mini Cooper wasn't in the garage. Tapshaw must be at her office, he thought. He knocked on Spears' door. There was no answer. He called out, Helen, you decent? There was still no answer. He tried to turn the knob. It was locked. That wasn't unusual. He locked his door too. He could have picked it, but he didn't want to risk it. If she had a camera in there. He went to his room, looked up the number for NYU Law School, and placed a call. He was passed from person to person and department to department until he came to a man who seemed to be the right one. Devine said, My daughter, Helen Spears, just graduated from NYU. I haven't been able to reach her and I'm getting concerned. She still lives in the same apartment. I'm on the West Coast. I wanted someone to go and check on her. That might be a matter for the police, Mr. Spears. Look, I paid a ton of money for her to go to law school there. Can you at least help me? Please hold for just a moment. He heard classical music for about 30 seconds before the man came back on. He said in a somewhat snarky tone, We have no record of any Helen Spears being enrolled at the law school or having just graduated, Mr. Spears. You might want to check with your daughter about that. Have a good day. Devine put down the phone. Okay, Helen Spears is not who she claims to be. So who is she, and why is she here? Devine thought back and recalled that Spears had come here just about the time he had. Was she a plant? If so, by whom? She had been very curious about everything, telling him time and again to let her recommend a lawyer for him. Since she hadn't gone to law school, he wondered what she would have done if he had taken the woman up on her offer. And where did she go during the day with her briefcase? His phone buzzed. It was a number he didn't recognize. Hello?
Mr. Devine?
Yes.
This is Dr. John Wyman. You called my office seeking information on Sarah Hughes.
Devine tensed.
Yes, I did. I worked with her. We were friends. So you said in your message. What exactly do you want to know?
I know that she was pregnant, but she ended up aborting the baby.
I knew about her pregnancy. I didn't know she had terminated it.
I talked to the doctor who helped with the abortion. Sarah wasn't that far along, so it seems no medical procedure was necessary.
So a medication abortion, then, said Wyman. Probably done at home.
Yes.
Sarah gave your name to the abortion clinic. Are you her OBGYN? Not exactly.
I don't understand.
Can you tell me of your interest in all this? Asked Wyman.
As I said, I worked with her and, well, the police and her mother seemed to think that I was the father, even though I didn't meet Sarah until after she became pregnant. I'm not sure they believe that. Quite frankly, I think they want to make me out to be her murderer.
I thought that might be it.
What? Devine said sharply.
I know you're not the father of Sarah Hughes' baby.
How?
Because she underwent artificial insemination and utilized a donor in acquiring the sperm. I run a practice pretty much devoted to that. I told the police this when they came by to see me as well, which is why I'm telling you. They mentioned your name, not understanding at that point how Sarah became pregnant. When I told them, they were quite surprised. They wanted to know if you had donated the sperm. I told them that you had not. I told them that Sarah never mentioned you to me. When I saw your name on the message my receptionist took from you, I put two and two together and decided you needed to know the truth.
Well, I appreciate that, Dr. Wyman. Do you know who donated the sperm?
No, I do not. Sarah provided it. I told the police that, too.
Then how do you know it wasn't me?
About 6 weeks after she became pregnant through insemination, Sarah told me that the sperm donor had died. You obviously are very much alive.
Was it Detective Shoemaker and Ekman who talked to you?
Yes, and they seemed very disappointed to know that you were not the father.
I'm sure they were.
Did Sarah have anyone with her when she consulted you or when she had the insemination done?
No.
But I got the sense that she was not going through this alone, that there was someone who was partnering with her in this process.
Devine thought of Jennifer Stamos, and then Brad Cowell. Cowell said he hadn't had sex with Hughes, but with artificial insemination, he wouldn't have had to. She didn't mention any names.
She didn't, but from the little she volunteered, I had the impression that she was going to take time off to be with the child.
He paused.
Was there someone like that in her life that you knew of?
Possibly, said Devine vaguely, and he meant to be very vague.
Do you know how far along Sarah was when she terminated her pregnancy? Asked Wyman.
I was told about 8 weeks, so shortly after she told you, the sperm donor had passed away.
She seemed so excited about being a mother. I wonder what changed her mind.
So do I, thought Devine. Chapter 60. Devine heard Tapshaw's car pull into the one-car garage. Shortly thereafter, he heard her come up the stairs. He listened to her open and close her bedroom door a few moments later. He sat on his bed and thought about things. The problem was, there were too many things to think about. Later, he heard the front door open and the sound of footsteps came up the stairs. He could tell by the footfalls that it was Spears. Her door closed as well. Then he heard her bed spring squeak. He looked at his watch. 6:30. Spears would not expect him to be home. He walked over to the wall separating their bedrooms and put his ear to it. He heard clicking. She was on her laptop. He stood there, hoping that she might make a call and he could attempt to listen, but that didn't happen. The clicking stopped. A minute or so passed and her door opened, and she passed down the hall. He opened his door a crack to see her at the top of the stairs, dressed in her yoga clothes. She went down the steps. He slipped out and quietly moved over to her door. He tried the knob. It turned. She had forgotten to lock it or thought there was no need. He slowly opened it and glanced back at the stairs. Normally, Spears would take a good 45 minutes for her yoga routine. He stood in the doorway, looking around. The clothes she had obviously been wearing were lying on the floor. He glanced at the bed and thought for a moment of that sex-charged night, and then pushed that right out of his head. This woman he'd thought was a friend was a potential enemy. He eased into the room and closed the door softly behind him. He could also hear clicking coming from Tapshaw's room. She was obviously humming away on her monster screens. He did a quick search of the desk drawers and eyed the pile of law books that were stacked exactly as before. He opened the one on top and riffled through the pages. No marginalia, no highlighting. They were clearly for show. He went through the closet and bureau drawers and found nothing helpful. Her laptop and phone were time-locked and biometric protected and thus inaccessible. Her purse was there and he took out her wallet. All the cards and driver's license said Helen Spears and the picture on the license was her. He put the wallet back and looked under the bed. A suitcase was there with no name tag. It was empty. He lifted the mattress and saw it underneath. A Glock 17 in black matte finish with pebbled grips and a big dot tritium night sight. He put the mattress back in place and left. As he was closing the door to leave, a voice said,
"What are you doing, Travis?"
He turned to see Tapshaw in the doorway of her room, holding a large coffee cup with Hummingbird's logo. He said, "I was looking for Helen. I thought she was in her room. I had given her a book to read that I needed back, but I couldn't find it."
"Oh, I think she's downstairs doing her yoga."
"Thanks. I didn't hear her."
"Why are you home so early? Did you get fired?"
He grinned at her remark. "Some days I wish I had."
"Want some coffee? I'm gonna make some."
"No, I'm good, thanks. I'll ask Helen about the book later. No need to bother her if you were going to."
"No problem."
She glanced at him.
"Are you sure you're okay, Travis? You just seem, I don't know, out of sorts."
He decided to tell her the truth. "Another woman from my office was found dead at her home." She just stared at him for a moment. Then she shivered, shook her head, and said in a low voice,
"Another woman? Was she..."
"She was killed, yes." Tears appeared in Tapshaw's large eyes.
"Oh, God. I just don't understand how..."
I got another email from that same source. Can I forward it to you to see if it helps you trace the other one?" She looked at him with determination.
"Definitely. I will trace it, Travis."
Tapshaw turned, walked back into her room, and closed the door. He heard the lock turn. And who could blame her, he thought. At 11:30 that night, Devine was awoken by movement in the hall. He listened for a moment, then rose and opened his door a crack. Spears was in her nightgown and was peering down the steps leading to the main level. When she turned back around, he eased the door closed. He heard her walk back down the hall, and then a door opened. He looked out again and saw her enter Valentine's room. She closed the door behind her. Devine slipped out into the hall and wondered if Spears was enjoying a sexual encounter with Valentine as she had with him. "Why should I be special?" But then he heard snores wafting up from the main floor. He edged down the stairs and saw Valentine sleeping on the couch. Now he understood. That was why she had gone there first, to make sure the Russian wasn't in his bedroom. Devine went back to his room. A couple of minutes later, there was a knock at his door. "Yeah?"
"It's Helen."
"Give me a sec." Devine sat up in his bed, laid his pillow next to his right hand, sat back against the headboard, and slipped his hand under the pillow where it gripped something. "Come on in." The door opened, and Spears stood there in her nightgown that hit at mid-thigh. It was transparent enough with the backlight from the hall illumination to get his full attention. She had nothing on underneath. "What's up?" he said evenly.
"I've missed you."
"I've been here all evening."
"You know what I mean."
"Do I?" thought Devine. "With the way you're dressed, I guess I do, yeah." She came in and closed the door behind her, locking it. I'm not sure Jill and Valentine are asleep.
I think Jill went out. Will is snoring on the couch. Pizza and beer do it every time. He's gonna have a coronary any day now.
She sat on the bed next to him, drawing her legs under her, and studied him. He made no move to draw closer.
What? You're no longer interested?
I'm just trying to understand why a young, beautiful, newly graduated lawyer needs to knock on my door. You can do a lot better than a 30-something Wall Street wannabe like me.
You undersell yourself, Travis. You're good-looking. And you're working in a field where you can make a lot of money. That's an attractive package. And you were a soldier, too, so you know how to take care of yourself. And me.
I don't think you'd have any problem taking care of yourself, thought Divine. She reached out and put a hand on his thigh.
It's not complicated, Travis.
It's all complicated, Helen. And for that reason, I think you need to go back to your room. She eyed where his hand was under the bed, and he saw something in her expression he didn't care for. She knows.
All right. But remember one thing.
What's that?
I never sleep with my enemies.
He heard her feet padding back to her room, where she closed her door. Divine sat up and pulled the SIG P226 out from under the pillow. He looked down at the gun, which looked similar to Spears's Glock, at least to the untrained eye. What the hell was she doing searching Valentine's room? And was the visit tonight just about showing me she's my ally? Then it dawned on him. She knows I searched her room. I put everything back just so. But I must have been a millimeter off somewhere. So the lady is good. Real good. And if she is my ally, that's also really good for me. But if she's lying, and she's my enemy. Chapter 61. 6:20. Right on time. Divine was really starting to hate this commute. Actually, there's no starting about it. He looked, but there was no Michelle Montgomery at the pool. He didn't imagine she would be told to wear the green bikini for a while, if ever. Later, he walked into the lobby at Cowell & Cumley, waved at Sam the guard, and took the elevator up to his floor. Turning a corner, he nearly tripped over the custodian, Jerry Myers, who was kneeling in front of a door fixing the lock.
Sorry, said Divine.
The man looked up, and recognition sprang into his features.
You were the one asking questions that day.
I was. Myers stood and put his tools back in the box on the floor.
Now there's another one, they say. Only she wasn't killed here, thank God. Couldn't take finding another body. I'm sure.
The police got any leads?
Myers asked.
Not that I know of, but they're not keeping me in their confidences.
Myers hefted his toolbox.
You guys slaving away in this place. I mean, you ask me, it's not worth it. No, sir.
Maybe it's not.
So why do it?
When I figure it out, I'll let you know.
Got a question. I understand that contractors and other service people come in through the rear entrance.
That's right. There's a phone they have to use. Goes to the security desk. Then they go let the person in if they're authorized.
Or if they have a security card, they can get in that way.
Sure, but contractors don't have security cards. That'd be a problem. Can't just let folks waltz in the back door like that.
Right. Thanks.
Later, around 2 PM, Divine was working away in his cubicle when the door opened.
Mr. Divine.
He looked up and saw the same woman who had previously come to retrieve him motioning to him. He rose, looked around at the burners watching him suspiciously, and made his way out. Detectives Ekman and Shoemaker were waiting for him.
Now what? He said. This way, barked Shoemaker.
They led him to the same room as before. Sitting across from him, Shoemaker said,
We talked to the guard on duty at night. He said that you and Stamos came into the building late on the day Hughes' body was found, and then left at the same time.
That's not true.
You saying the guard's lying?
Ekman said sharply. No, he just misinterpreted what he saw. I didn't know Stamos was in the building that night. I came back for my phone and did some work, then I left, alone. Did the guard say Stamos and I were together? The detectives exchanged glances.
Did you meet up with her in the building? Asked Shoemaker. No, and I'll take a polygraph on that if you want. Did you meet up with her later? Now they were getting into dangerous territory, but since he had asked the question, Devine suspected the man already knew the answer. It wasn't a meeting. I went to a bar in Greenwich Village. She was there. We talked.
And you never mentioned this before because...
I saw her in a bar. So did a lot of other people.
You seem to use that excuse a lot, said Ekman.
Because it's true.
We understand that you two argued in that bar, and then you kicked the shit out of three guys in the alley next to the bar, and that she saw the whole thing.
I did have a fight with three guys, yes.
Over Stamos?
It could be construed that way.
And again, you never mentioned that to us because...
What relevance would it have?
You've got to be kidding, right?
Said Ekman. That all happened before she was killed, in case you forgot. And by the way, I found out that Sarah's pregnancy was from artificial insemination. Thanks for telling me that. You knew I wasn't the father all along.
Just to get this straight, we don't have to tell you jack shit, barked Ekman.
And how did you find out about that?
Asked Shoemaker, leaning forward and drilling Devine with a hard stare. I got the name of the doctor from Mrs. Hughes. I called him. He told me.
And why would he do that?
Because he thought you guys were trying to pin the murder on me. Shoemaker sat back and said,
And we understand Stamos came to visit you at your place in Mount Kisco. You two had another argument.
Shit. How could they have found that out? Helen Spears? She did come out to my place, but we didn't have an argument. We just talked.
What did you talk about?
Sarah.
What about yous?
Just chit-chat.
Devine, you are 1 inch from being arrested for obstruction, exclaimed Shoemaker. So you better consider your next answer really carefully. What did you discuss about yous?
Stamos said that she also knew I wasn't the father of Yuse's baby. She didn't come out and say it, but reading between the lines, she knew that Yuse had gone the artificial insemination route. Ekman shot his partner a look.
Wait a minute. From all we learned, those ladies were rivals at the firm. Why would they be talking about babies and such?
Devine decided to just tell the truth. He could tell he was close to being put in jail, and he couldn't very well do much from there. Stamos told me that she and Hughes, that they were in love. Devine expected both detectives to finally blow up at him. Instead, Shoemaker cracked a smile.
Finally, we get some truth out of you.
What do you mean by that? Said Devine curiously. Did you find something to back up what I just told you?
Stamos's place has been searched. Electronics all gone. Phone and computer are probably at the bottom of the Hudson by now.
Did you find something online then? Instagram? Facebook?
No, we checked all that. There was nothing.
Not surprising, said Devine. There are rules against employees seeing each other. He thought for a moment about Stamos and Cal, but he really wasn't an employee. Shoemaker said,
But we talked to one of Stamos's sisters. Apparently she'd confided in her.
So you know I'm telling the truth then?
Just about that. Devine. But there's a lot about you that neither one of us likes.
Well, when that becomes a crime, be sure to let me know.
Chapter 62. Devine left work around 8 and headed to check in with the Hugheses. They might go back to New Zealand any time now. Ellen Hughes had made it clear that she loathed the city, and he wanted to find out if they knew about Stamos and their daughter. Or about Sarah's being artificially inseminated. Ellen Hughes hadn't mentioned that fact. She hadn't really said whether she knew her daughter was pregnant before the police had told her. She was just furious about the termination of that pregnancy. Devine wanted to ask her directly. She struck him as the sort that kept a lot back. He got to the house and knocked, but there was no answer. He looked through the side light next to the door, but could see nothing.
Mr. and Mrs. Hughes?
He knocked again and tried the knob. It was unlocked, just like in the movies. He pushed it open and poked his head in.
Hello? Ellen? Fred? It's Travis Devine. I just wanted to talk to you for a minute.
He went inside and closed the door behind him.
Hello? Anybody here?
The place was dark, with the dim outside light being the only illumination.
He walked through the front room and peeked into the kitchen. Nothing, although there were some dirty dishes in the sink and an empty coffee cup was on the table. He walked toward the bedroom and looked in there. The bed was made, and the bathroom was empty. His gaze lingered on the bed for a moment. It was there that he and Yuse had had sex, once, and then she had broken it off. He thought she had found another guy. But then to find out she and Stamos were in love? He shook his head. He'd had no inkling that Yuse had been gay or maybe bisexual, yet she had obviously wanted a child. But then why go through all the steps necessary for artificial insemination and then terminate the pregnancy? But now that he thought about it, the timing was off. The pregnancy had occurred before Divine had even met Yuse. If she and Stamos were going to have a baby together, why would Yuse sleep with him? They must have gotten together afterward. Then maybe Sarah had a relationship with someone else along with the pregnancy? Then was that relationship broken off and the pregnancy terminated? Was that how she fell into bed with me? A rebound off another guy or another woman? With Yuse, Divine had thought he might have finally found a woman with whom he could spend the rest of his life. In addition to being beautiful, Yuse had been kind and funny and smart and caring. There had been a spark from their first meeting, which led to other meetings. During firm outings, they had ended up spending time together, talking and secretly planning to see each other. Everything had to be kept on the QT because of company rules. And then they had come here and slept together. It had been immensely satisfying to Divine. He had even thought about quitting Cowell and getting another job so that Yuse and he could come out in the open. But after that night together, she had withdrawn from him, and finally the end had come. Not in an email or a text, just a look from her in the hallway and a mouthed, "I'm sorry, Travis." And that had been it. And if Yuse was attracted to women instead of men, he could understand her decision. One had to be who one was. He turned and walked to what he knew was the guest bedroom. Outside in the hall were two large roller suitcases. He looked at the tags. They were the Yuse's. They had flown on United from California to here after the much longer journey from New Zealand to the Golden State. He stepped inside the bedroom and flicked on the light, and Divine stopped right in the doorway. Ellen and Fred were in bed. They would not be waking back up. There was blood all over the bed covers, and they were staring up at the ceiling with lifeless eyes. Ellen Yuse looked surprised. Fred just looked like he was watching TV. Divine slipped over and touched the woman's skin. Ice. He tried to bend her arm. Still pretty stiff. He knew that meant rigor was already well established. They'd been dead a while, he knew. Divine had seen his share of stiff bodies in the Middle East. He looked for what had killed them. There were slashes in the covers around their chests. A knife, probably. It was a savage attack. He retreated, wiping off his prints along the way. He poked his head out the front door and looked all around. The coast right now was reasonably clear, at least he hoped. He stepped out and closed the door with his coat sleeve over his hand. He set off at a rapid pace and called Campbell along the way and told him what he had discovered.
"Get as far away from there as you can," said the old general. "Full retreat, Divine."
"But what about the bodies? The police have to be notified."
"Leave that to us."
Divine clicked off and picked up his pace. He reached the subway on Fulton Street and made his way back to Grand Central, covering the 4 miles in about 12 minutes. He retraced his train's morning route and eyed Cal's place closely when they reached it, looking for any sign of activity, but saw none. He had seen his share of violent death in war, bodies mangled beyond all recognition, people he knew and fought alongside. He had grieved and moved on, because you had to in a war zone. But the two bodies in the bed, it had sickened him, shaken him right to his core. He was no longer in a war zone, but it felt like he was. Divine didn't make eye contact with anyone the whole ride home. He grabbed a cab at the station because his legs were rubbery, took it home, went up to his room and sat on his bed, trying to make sense of what had just happened. Who would want to kill the Yuses? The same people who killed Sarah? But Sarah was killed because she had found out that Cal and Cumley was a laundering machine. She knew about the Lombard. She probably knew a lot more. Stamos the same. But why the parents? Ellen Yu said she and her daughter were estranged. Why would Sarah have told her mother and father anything about Cal and Cumley? And if she hadn't, why would someone kill her parents? Because the killer was afraid she might have told her parents something? Or since her mom and dad were staying at Sarah's place, the killer might have feared the Yuses would find something damaging? Something felt off about that. But what else could it be? He went downstairs and grabbed a Coke from the fridge. There was no one here, which was a good thing because Divine didn't want to deal with any of his roommates right now. He sat at the small kitchen table and looked out the window. Someone might have seen him enter and leave Sarah Hughes' old home, where two butchered bodies lay. Campbell said he would take care of notifying the police, but even with that, Divine expected a visit from Shoemaker and Ekman. And as unpleasant as the first few encounters had been, he assumed the next one would be the worst of all. If they could find any reason to arrest him, they would. He heard the front door open, and a few moments later, Will Valentine poked his head into the kitchen.
Locust group, he said.
What about it? Asked Divine, perking up. Did you find stuff? Valentine sat down next to him and opened his laptop.
They own shitload of stuff. I mean, shitload.
I know of three different places in the city alone.
Three? Dude, give me a fucking break.
He hit a key on his laptop and screen after screen of line items associated with properties and other assets flashed across it. Wait a minute, that's all Locust? Exclaimed Divine.
AF computer stop count at 141,312 different properties, assets, and businesses in 57 countries, but most of it in America. That is tip of iceberg. It is serious shit. In all 50 states, and they are buried deep so nobody will find out. I track Locust Group through shell companies, consortiums, ASPECs, investment funds, tech shelters, CBOs, derivatives, debt funds. They own whole fucking towns in Idaho and Wyoming and Montana and Alabama and Arkansas and other places. And they own whole blocks in New York, Chicago, Los Angeles, Atlanta, Houston, and other big cities. Gold and silver mines, uranium, chemical, and manufacturing plants, oil refineries. They own sports teams and TV and radio stations and newspapers and streaming platforms, social media sites, and a whole shitload of other stuff. Never seen anything like it, dude. I mean, not even Putin is this fucking big. And never in my life did I think I would ever say that.
How much asset value are we talking about?
Shit, maybe 40 trillion.
Divine gaped. How far back do some of the transactions go?
I find slew of them back over 15 years.
Okay, that fits with other things I've found out.
What is going on, Travis?
Money laundering, probably. For example, your buddy Putin and his friends have dirty money to get rid of, money they steal from the Russian people, right?
Shit, yes. Putin is so rich he makes Bezos and Musk look poor. But he say he is not rich and nobody disagrees with him because they get shot or poisoned or put in prison.
So the dirty money comes over here and is used to buy all sorts of assets. Then instead of dirty money, you own a house or a building or a company or a chunk of the Dow Jones, whatever. That's why they call it money laundering. Valentine nodded.
I know this. Clean money, dude. That is the name of game.
But it's not just about owning assets. With radio and TV and newspapers and online streaming platforms and social media sites and owning whole towns and city blocks, they can manipulate and control everything, from cradle to grave.
Dude, that is not good. That is Russia.
Can you send me all that stuff? I've got someone I want to show it to. Valentine looked at him curiously as he did this.
You're not what you want us to think.
Are you?
Just a hacker, dude.
A good one.
Take you long enough to say, asshole.
But he tacked on a grin to this. Valentine opened the fridge, grabbed a beer, and walked off, while Divine stared down at his hands, thinking. Something Valentine had said had stuck in his head and had made him think of Cal's own words from that old interview with the Journal. A partnership can be simply an idea or a perspective. He grabbed his laptop from his room and plugged in the name Ann Cumley, running it through a popular site on the internet that he had used before, but then only for fun. There was nothing fun about the exercise this time. It didn't take long for the program to kick out what Divine knew was the exact right answer. An anagram for Anne Cumley was clean money. Chapter 63. Divine would not be taking the 620 in that morning. He knew that as soon as he saw Detective Shoemaker and Ekman waiting for him at the Mount Kisco train station. Shoemaker tapped out a smoke, and both men came forward.
Pretty early for you guys to be all the way out here.
Come on, we'll drive you to work this morning, Divine, courtesy of NYPD, said Ekman.
His tone was friendlier, which bothered Divine greatly. Was it just a facade before the hammer came down? They started off, Divine in the rear seat. He was waiting for the question, and it wasn't long in coming. He just needed to pull off the surprised part.
Fred and Ellen Hughes are dead.
Before Divine could reply in a shocked manner, Ekman turned and looked at him.
We know you already know.
Divine nearly swallowed his tongue on that one.
And we know you got an alibi. We talked to your friend, Helen Spears. You were with her at the townhouse during the time in question.
You talked to Helen? When?
That's none of your concern, pointed out Shoemaker. I thought you'd be thrilled she'd provided an alibi.
So is that when they were killed? He asked. Ekman nodded.
Between 11 and 1 that night, yeah. Stabs to the heart. Died pretty quickly. But whoever it was just kept right on stabbing him. It was damn vicious. I've been doing this job a long time. It was one of the worst I've seen.
Shoemaker said,
You have friends in high places. You should have told us.
I would if I could have.
So 3 people dead who were connected to Sarah Hughes, who was also murdered. And what was her sin?
She was connected to Brad Cowell, who has disappeared.
So he killed her?
He was probably in the building that night. He got a call that I believe was from Stamos on the night she was killed. He headed out in time to murder her. Her phone record should show that.
And why would he do that?
My friends in high places didn't enlighten you?
The only message we got was that you were a good guy on a government mission and to have your back.
Ekman added,
So what's so special about Cowell?
Some things have come to light, but I can't share them with you. Not that I don't want to, but fruit of a tainted tree sort of thing. If I infect the cops with it, the case is dead and the man walks. Ekman nodded.
Okay, that makes sense. So Cowell is a bad guy. Is his money dirty? Is that what this is about?
It's not his money. It belongs to other people. People from outside this country. And that's really all I can say. If the folks above me want to say more, that's up to them. Ekman and Shoemaker exchanged a look. Ekman said,
Okay, but we're homicide. Financial crimes are another division. We just want whoever killed these people, and it looks like it's Cowell to you.
Or someone working for him. Rich guys don't usually do the deed, do they? They hire others to do it, like that Hancock guy. Speaking of, why would he focus on me out of all people?
We don't know, said Ekman.
And he also knew before it was made public that Sarah had not killed herself, that it was murder. Did you give someone a heads up on that? Shoemaker said,
Brad Cowell is a very important guy in this town. He's been very generous with certain people at NYPD and City Hall. I'm not saying any heads up came from there, but I wouldn't be surprised if it did.
Ekman interjected.
But from what you said, Cowell might have done Stamos himself.
He might have.
There might not have been time to hire a gun.
By the way, how did she die? Ekman glanced at Shoemaker.
It goes no further, Divine.
It won't.
The killer drugged her, then tied her to her bed, and then carved the word bitch on her belly. She bled out.
Divine felt the little breakfast he'd eaten start to come back up on him. He bent forward and stared at the floorboard, his breathing short and choppy. After about 30 seconds, he sat up straight and looked at the 2 men. Shoemaker almost appeared sympathetic.
Yeah, I know, he said quietly. Pretty sick.
Was Stamos pregnant?
No, that's what we thought too. Emmy confirmed that she wasn't, replied Ekman. So why do it that way? It was to send a message, is what I'm thinking. What that message was, who knows?
And no one saw anything? Asked Devine.
Nope. We've checked. That late on a weekday in that neighborhood. Not surprising.
We think the killer got in through a window in the back. Stamos was on the first floor. No signs of a struggle. Same with the Hugheses. They were probably dead asleep.
Ekman blanched.
Sorry, bad choice of words.
So the Hughes family got wiped out, said Shoemaker thoughtfully.
Which seemed to be the killer's intent, but why? Why did they have to die? They just got to the country. What possible beef could someone have with them? Is it just the connection with their daughter?
And her connection to Brad Cowell? Added Ekman.
If he is involved in some crooked money scheme and maybe Sarah Hughes found out, they could have been afraid that she had told her parents something.
I was thinking that too, but now I seriously doubt that actually happened, said Devine. She was estranged from her parents. They were Christian missionaries, and I don't think they would have had any interest in or understanding of any part of Sarah's world.
You mean her and Stamos being a thing, like you told us before?
Yes, her mother was not in favor of same-sex couples and made no secret of it.
But how could someone even know that? They just got to New York.
Well, I found out just by being around her for a few minutes. And she thought her daughter was a slut sleeping around outside a marriage. Shoemaker said,
We seem to be going in circles. If all these deaths aren't connected to the cow business, what then?
Devine thought back to the emails he had gotten, the one that not even the likes of Will Valentine could trace, and he didn't know if Campbell's people would have better luck, although he was hoping Tapshaw and her magical fingers could do the trick.
Was the killer trying to let me know that I'm involved in all this? Do they blame me for what happened to Sarah and Jennifer? Who would have that sort of grudge against me? What have I done?
He debated on whether to share this with the detectives, but decided not to. It would just piss them off that he had withheld such evidence, and they were getting along so well right now.
You said the Hugheses were stabbed in the heart?
Right through, yeah. Why?
Asked Shoemaker. The heart symbolizes emotions, beliefs, feelings.
So?
Said Ekman. I don't know, just thinking out loud. Maybe the killer murdered each person in ways to symbolize the reason why they were killed. Ekman and Shoemaker exchanged another interested glance.
Sarah Hughes was hanged. What does that symbolize? Asked Ekman.
Well, said Devine, in the past, they used to hang traitors. So when does my turn come?
Chapter 64. It was barely noon, and the news of Fred and Ellen Hughes having been murdered had circulated throughout Cowell and Cumley. Devine abruptly left his office and sought out Wanda Sims.
Any idea where Mr. Cowell is? He asked.
I'm not his keeper, Travis,
the woman said sharply, but then her look immediately softened.
I'm sorry, but this is all getting to me. Four people have been murdered. And two of them worked here, and the other victims were the parents of one of them.
You'd think the head of the company would be around to lead the troops? She looked at him skeptically.
For all I know, he jetted off to some island with a group of swimsuit models. But if you say I told you that, I'll deny it.
Have you spoken to his little group of executives?
I have. And they won't say a word about him. Too afraid, I would imagine.
I would imagine, too. Wanda, do you have any idea what's on the 51st floor? Her look immediately became guarded.
Why? What's it to you?
Four people have been killed, like you said, and that floor is the only one that no one can access.
Oh, come on, Travis. Every investment house has secure areas. It's probably where the high-frequency trading takes place. Just servers and the like. Did you ever think of that?
Yes, I did, thought Devine. One more thing. Did you tell anyone that I had come up to the 52nd floor on the morning Sarah's body was found? She looked warily at him.
Why?
Just trying to figure something out.
I might have mentioned it to Jen Stamos, actually. Now she's dead, too. And she was really broken up about Sarah's death. I didn't think they were that friendly.
Well, you just never know. Thanks. So that's why Hancock was sicked on me so fast. Stamos might have learned from Sarah that we had slept together, and then I show up asking questions. She tells Cal, and Cal gives marching orders to Hancock, or Bartlett, rather, to go play detective and find out what he can. And Stamos also told Cal I had come back to the building that night and that the guard saw me. He checked the security log, and there was my security card for the 52nd floor. And then he sees my security card login and my face on the video on the night Sarah died and plans to frame me. And he also thought that might be why Rachel Potter from Channel 44 had been on his case, too. One of her confidential or probably anonymous sources might have been Hancock/Bartlett using her to put the squeeze on him. He texted Campbell, asking for a meeting. He got a nearly instant reply and location. He left Cowell and headed for the 50s again. And on the way, he got another email from the untraceable source. I was surprised I could find Mr. and Mrs. Hughes's hearts to stab. The world is better off without them. I hope you agree. Devine slowly put the phone away and kept walking, but with every step, the dread he was feeling grew like a cancer, creeping to every organ he had. The restaurant door opened for Devine, and he slipped inside. Campbell was waiting for him in the same room.
Thanks for running interference for me last night.
I take it the detectives assigned to the case have made contact?
Early this morning. They're playing nice.
Good. We have been monitoring Area 51. It's still shut down.
I had a buddy of mine dig up some things on the Locust Group. He went on to tell the general about how many companies and assets and countries were involved.
My folks are finding the same thing. And it goes far beyond the Locust Group. We saw a great many entities that appeared regularly on the surveillance feed, even in the short time we had access before it was shut down.
Devine also told him about his theory on the name Ann Cumley being an anagram.
Clean money. I think you must be right.
Were you able to trace those emails? Because I just got another one. He showed Campbell the latest message. The general sighed and sat back.
The long and short of it is no. The general consensus is that none of my IT people have seen anything like this.
Devine said, I received that first email on the day that Sarah's body was found. As you saw, it had intimate details about the murder that only the killer would know. At first, I thought someone else had found her body and emailed me because, well, they knew that I liked Sarah.
I think it was more than liked, Devine.
He looked at the general with a blank expression.
I have 3 sons and 2 daughters, soldier. I've seen broken hearts before.
Devine looked at the general with a new level of respect. As far as I know, I'm the only one who got those emails.
The killer must be someone at the firm. We thought that all along, didn't we?
Yes, and there's something else. The way the people were killed, Sarah hanged, Stamos.
Yes, I know all about that. Continue.
And Sarah's parents stabbed through the heart. I think each was symbolic.
What's your take on what each one represents?
Sarah, the traitor. Stamos, well, I'm not sure, but her wounds reflected the killer's anger at maybe losing Sarah. And Stamos and Sarah were in love. And Sarah's parents' hearts were destroyed. And from what I learned of their relationship, it might mean the killer knows about Sarah and her mother's estrangement, too. The killer intimated that it was difficult for him to find their hearts, and that the world was better off without such people.
You know what all that adds up to, don't you?
Sir?
That the reasons these people were killed have nothing to do with Brad Cowell and Area 51, and everything to do with Sarah Hughes. Which means the matter is more for the police than it is for me and you. We need to focus on the scheme at Cowell and Cumley, Devine. The police can solve the murders.
But it could still be someone at Cowell's firm who committed the murders, countered Devine. Sarah was pregnant, and even though she had artificial insemination through a donor, we don't know who that donor was. Campbell looked intrigued by this theory.
You think it might have been Cowell? Because that would put it back in our camp.
Even though Devine had been told the donor had died, there was no proof of that. It's certainly possible. He said he never slept with her, but he could have donated his sperm, and he had motive, means, and opportunity.
So you have 2 different cases to solve, but maybe with a related core element. Brad Cowell. And then there's the question of who might be next, added Campbell. Devine looked up to see Campbell staring at him and perhaps reading his thoughts.
And that someone might be you, Campbell said.
Chapter 65. Devine was on his way to the subway after leaving work early when his phone rang. Michelle?
Where are you?
Walking up Broad Street and enjoying the heat, why?
Can you meet me at Brad's place later? The one outside the city?
Why?
I can't get into his penthouse without his phone, but I do have a key to the house. If he's not there, we can make a search. We might find something to nail that son of a bitch. And if he is there, we can, well, strangle the asshole.
Sounds good to me. Devine took the train home, changed, and was heading out when Tapshaw called out to him. He turned to see her at the top of the stairs.
I got an email this morning. Mayflower is going to pull the trigger and invest. $50 million, Travis. And at a valuation that will leave me with complete control of the company. This will change everything.
He tried to force a smile. Force, because if this was dirty money, and it had to be taken back. That's great, Jill. You must have really wowed them. And that valuation means you are rich. She blushed at this.
I've been scrimping and saving for so long, it doesn't feel any different. But I believe they definitely think there's a lot of potential in my platform and business plan. If I close the deal, how about another tequila date? You helped me a lot.
He again forced a smile. I'm all in, but my turn to buy. She put her hands on her hips.
Hell, Travis, with all that money, I think I can afford to splurge a little. And the $1,000 you put in, it's worth a lot more now.
He watched her walk off, and then his smile faded. Shit. He hopped on his bike and sped off to meet Montgomery. She was waiting outside the gates for him. She had Ubered out, she told him. What about the hired help? He asked.
They're used to me being around, and as I said before, they're no fans of Brad's.
They headed into the house, and a maid came around the corner and nearly plowed into them.
Oh my goodness, Miss Michelle, I'm sorry.
It's okay, Denise. Is Brad here? I've been calling and calling and nothing.
No, ma'am. I haven't seen him in a few days, but that's not unusual. He's so busy. He might be in China for all I know.
Right. Well, we're going to hang out here for a bit. Travis here works for Brad, and hopefully he'll show up. Look, why don't you and the rest of the crew take the rest of the night off? There's no reason for you to hang around.
But if Mr. Cowell...
If he shows up, I'll take full responsibility.
She smiled impishly.
And I can mix the man a drink myself if he so requires, and fry him an egg.
Denise grinned.
All right, miss, if you're sure.
10 minutes later, the staff had left and gone to their quarters on the other side of the property. Montgomery closed the door behind them and turned to Devine.
Let's hit it.
She led him into what looked like a home office. What exactly are we looking for?
Anything to show the guy is a crook.
And maybe a killer, he said.
2 people dead and...
It's now 4, actually. She whirled around to stare at him.
What?
Sarah Hughes's parents. They were murdered in their bed at Sarah's place 2 nights ago.
Oh my God. And you think Brad...
I don't know. I do know someone sent me, and apparently only me, an email detailing Sarah's crime scene. They also sent me messages about the murders of Stamos and the Hugheses. It has to have been the killer, which means the person has some beef with me, only I don't know why.
You had a thing going with Sarah. Maybe the killer knew and was jealous.
That would explain some things. And Stamos and Sarah were apparently a couple, but keeping it under wraps. Maybe that's why Stamos was killed.
And the parents?
The mother was outright hostile to Sarah's lifestyle. The email shows the killer didn't like that, but I'd like to know how the person knew about it.
It might have been in a diary or something.
Which the cops couldn't find.
Why would the killer care what her mother thought of Sarah?
I don't know.
Hey, maybe she broke up with the guy she was seeing. He was the father, and she ended the pregnancy because she didn't want to carry his baby.
I found out that Sarah had artificial insemination. She used a sperm donor.
But then why terminate the pregnancy?
Devine shook his head. No idea. They began searching the office. They found nothing helpful there and headed upstairs.
We have separate bedrooms. Brad's is at the end of the hall. It's about as big as my apartment.
They went inside the chamber, which was really a suite with multiple rooms and every rich guy toy one could hope for. Two fireplaces, enormous TVs, a full bar, a sitting area, a spa with steam room, sauna, and whirlpool, a massage room, and a bathtub nearly large enough to do laps in, with a walk-in shower next to it that looked like a Roman grotto, and five classic pinball machines along with a pool table.
Who could sleep in here? He said. Too many distractions.
Devine looked at the bed that was about the size of his room. How do two people find each other on that?
Brad never had a problem finding me, I can assure you.
Don't go there, Michelle. I do not want to hear it. After a fruitless search, they perched on the bed and gazed out the floor-to-ceiling tinted windows.
So what now?
The penthouse is a no-go. Area 51 the same. So, I'm not sure what now. Devine's phone buzzed. It was Campbell.
We need to talk right away.
Where are you? Asked Devine.
The first place we met.
I can be there in 30 minutes. He glanced at Montgomery. Mind if I bring along someone?
Who?
Devine told him.
That is not a good idea, Devine. We have no idea if she's working for Cal and just stringing you along.
Devine looked at Montgomery. I've trusted her with my life, and she came through. She's had plenty of opportunities to throw me to the dogs, and she hasn't. I've told her a lot, and if she had ratted me out to Cal, I wouldn't be around.
This is highly unusual, Devine.
You recruited me, sir. I'm not a trained spy or intel officer. I'm flying by the seat of my pants. But in the Middle East, I spent years reading people, trying to decide if they were trustworthy or would betray me when the opportunity arose. And I got damn good at it. So I'm just asking you to trust me on this. Soldier to soldier.
See you in 30.
Montgomery stared at him fearfully.
You're a spy?
I don't know what I am, really.
Who the hell was that?
You're about to find out.